This is a YUN interview with Fred Eckert regarding Namibia, done in New York City on February the 16th, 1999. The interviewer is Sutherland. So, Fred, first of all, I want to thank you very much for giving your time and attention to this oral history project of Yale, dealing with the United Nations. And as you know, we are including Namibia as one of the subjects which we are covering, and you were there. So I'd like to talk to you this evening about your experience there and of your perceptions of the Namibia transition. And I'd like to begin by asking, how did you get there? In other words, what was your position before you went to Namibia in the United Nations, and how were you chosen?
I was a junior member of the spokesman's office for the Secretary General in New York, and I believe that the spokesman thought I'd be better off in the field. He recommended me for the job as an assistant to the spokesman, who had already been designated by Mr. Ahtisaari going back 10 years. And Ahtisaari was extremely loyal to the people who worked for him, and he tried to bring back as many of the people from 1978 as he could. And in the case of the spokesman, this was a Tunisian who I believe at the time was an information center director in Tunis. We still hadn't learned the lesson at that time that you need a spokesman in place with the advance team. And already the force commander who was in place, troops were arriving, he was besieged by press, and he was screaming to New York, send me an information person. Meanwhile, the Tunisian was stuck in North Africa with a house to get rid of and a family to move to New York before he went off to Namibia, and they needed someone else, and so the spokesman recommended that I be sent. So that's how it happened.
And when did you get there?
I don't mean the exact date, but I mean the critical date is April the 1st, because that's the day when the peace plan was supposed to come into effect.
My recollection is I arrived the first week of March, and so we were reporting primarily on logistics at that time. The chief of staff of Mr. Ahtisaari, Cedric Thornberry, had a keen interest in press relations, and when he arrived shortly before the 1st of April, he took over on the political side. So for 3 weeks or so, I just held the fort and reported primarily on logistics and arrivals of troops.
Reporting to whom?
Well, there was quite a gathering of press there. Certainly the Namibia itself had a quite developed press corps. The South Africans had keen interest. I seem to recall that there may have been some Portuguese press there as well. So the press were descending on Namibia. It was a news story for those regional media.
I want to move ahead for a moment, a little bit out of order, so to speak, because you mentioned Cedric Thornberry, and the various people I talked to who were in the field. He was one of the people at headquarters whose name was relatively well known. His name was also well known in New York, as I think you know, not always favorably. What was his position exactly, and how did he figure in the headquarters staff?
Well, again, he was one of those with a long-standing relationship with Mr. Ahtisaari, going back to the days when Mr. Ahtisaari had been Finnish ambassador, I believe in Lusaka, Zambia, with responsibility for Namibia as well. And Cedric Thornberry was something like an Amnesty International lawyer, taking the side of Namibian politicians and political activists against the South African legal system. And Cedric had gotten into some difficulty, I believe, in the peacekeeping department at the UN, and there were people who thought that his ouster from the UN was the last he'd ever would be seen there, but it was Marty Ahtisaari who, in a sense, resurrected him and brought him back as, I would describe it as chief of staff. And I think it was his finest hour because he, first of all, he was very close to Marty, and that's important to have a headquarters unit at the top that's coherent. Second, as chief of staff, he could speak, therefore, with Marty's authority. And third, he organized the mission, at least from my point of view, as far as a gatherer of information, in an interesting way. He had three tiers or three separate reporting chains. He had the political officers in the field who reported daily. He had the police, which were his special responsibility. I seem to recall Marty asked him to keep an eye on the civilian police, which were a very important component of this mission, and more or less established the importance of civilian police to peacekeeping generally, and then the military, for which he didn't have a lot of respect. But he then had a staff at headquarters that was assigned to first the military. He had a military liaison person. The military were across town in a different base. So he had one person who went to that base and sat in on the force commander's morning meeting. He had a second person who did the same thing for the police commissioner's morning meeting. And then he had a cluster of others who divided the country by regions and who phoned, first received an overnight cable from the political officers in the field. And then the next morning, as they read the cables of what happened the day before, they phoned these field offices to ask follow-up questions to what was in the cables and to get any late-breaking developments. And all of that was before a morning meeting of all these people that he held at maybe 10 o'clock, or maybe it was 11 o'clock. Might have been 11 o'clock. And so it was interesting. If something slipped by the military and the police, then the civilian picked it up. Rarely did anything important slip through all three nets. And then he was quite a terrorist, because if the police failed to report something important that had come in on the civilian net, he would tell his officer that was dealing with the police commissioner, you go down there and you chew him out and you tell him his people missed something important, and next time they better get it right. And he liked putting the fear of God into people, but I must say, I sat in that morning meeting and I had a good sense of what was going on in the country. I then gave a press briefing at noon, and the journalists, of course, are always the first to know anything, and if I could just hold my own when they said, well, we understand a man was killed in Wundu last night, I could say, yes, we had a report on that, and the police are investigating it. It was very helpful to me. So I ran a reasonably well-informed press briefing each day, and it was thanks to this system that Cedric devised and I think worked beautifully.
Now, at the next level up, that is the top level, there was kind of a three-headed team in the special representative, his deputy, and the military, the field commander. How did that work? How did they function?
Well, of course, we're going back to this 1978 team.
Mm-hmm.
So after 10 years, both the police commissioner and the force commander were feeling a bit tired. They were not particularly energetic. They had good staff. That's not to say that they weren't good leaders, but they weren't forceful, which again left Cedric in an unchallenged number two position until LaGuayla was brought in as a deputy.
Mm-hmm.
And that was of interest to me politically. First of all, Atassari felt very comfortable with LaGuayla. And I don't know whether the Secretary General made that appointment consciously. I assumed he did. And second, I believe Cedric had the office opposite Atassari's, which was a two-office suite with a secretarial pool in the middle. And Cedric vacated that office, and LaGuayla walked into a newly furnished, freshly refurnished, executive office right across from Atassari, and was immediately brought in to the top level of decision making. And as far as I never heard Joe LaGuayla complain that he had not been fully consulted.
So it worked well.
Yes. And so the three who ran the mission, mm-hmm, were Marty, Joe, and Cedric,
mm-hmm,
and the force commander and police commissioner had secondary roles, as far as I could tell.
Yeah. Although I believe General Prenchon initially thought that he should be acting as deputy. Was that ever evident?
No. By the fact that he was off at a military base at the other end of town, didn't give him a good commanding position, mm-hmm, at headquarters. Second, he was a very refined gentleman, and he never elbowed his way into anyone's office or inner circle where he wasn't wanted. And third, as I mentioned, he was tired. I didn't sense he had a lot of fight in him.
He actually sent in his resignation to the Secretary General when the deputy was appointed.
Oh, really? I wasn't aware of that.
I wanted to go now to the relationship with the South African representatives in Vendorf. How was this handled, particularly Mr. I don't know how to pronounce his name,
Pinar,
and his staff?
I have less good recollections on that. I again seem to recall that Cedric took the lead on the relations with PNR, and basically felt that they were a group that needed enlightenment, that you had to twist their arms to get them to do the minimum required under the plan. He seemed to find them difficult to work with. But my sense was that the South Africans had made a firm commitment to go through with the independence of Namibia as a dry run for what they were going to have to do at home. And so our leverage with PNR came from the South Africans, who had a representative in Windhoek. Do you remember his name?
No.
I went out on a bribe with him in the bush. I spent a drunken afternoon with him and his wife. It was very pleasant. He was a very distinguished person. Got to drink on occasion, but a very distinguished person, and was always helpful. It was a good cop, bad cop routine that they played. PNR seemed to be defending the interests of the conservative elements in Namibian society, and the South African was prying things loose. And I don't know whether they designed it that way or whether, in fact, that's how it was, but that's how it worked.
Now, did these differences come out in your dealings with the press? In other words, did you have to go into the relationship with the South African representative, with the administrator, on such questions as the declaration on the electoral procedures, the declaration on the registration procedures, where there were differences, as I understand it, between what his office wanted and what UNTAG wanted?
The press were very well informed on all these matters, and of course the local press, which included the South African press, tended to be better informed than I was. There were, under Namibian legislation, precise things that needed to be done to promulgate these laws, and I seem to recall a lot of battles between Cedric on our side and PNR's people on their side. And everything, we briefed daily 5 days a week. So just about everything came before the press. It was a very free Western style press with a little bit of I want to say kind of naughtiness, because they were playful at the same time, but their playfulness could be designed to embarrass me in a superficial way, a silly way, which had a political motivation underneath it, to make UNTAG look silly. Give you an example. There was the Swapo-colored condom story, where UNICEF was distributing condoms to the refugees. They were ordered from an American company in one of the southern states. They came in four different colors, and three of the colors were indeed Swapo colors. And they asked me this question. They produced these things as evidence in a press briefing, and I turned red and dealt with it as best I could, and then immediately got on the phone to try to find out who made these condoms. And I called the company in Alabama or someplace, and I said, can you assure me that these particular colors were not ordered specifically and that they are your standard colors? And they gave me the assurance, but by that time the joke was over, and I just looked silly, and there was a fair amount of that. They were earthy, they were cunning in a political way, and they probably got the better of me more than once.
And I judge you're suggesting it was a fairly sophisticated press corps then.
Certainly, the police leaked to them photographs of murder victims, the kinds of things that police normally don't show to the press. PNR's office briefed them, gave them his side of the story regularly. And of course, we were putting out our story every day and trying to return as many of the balls as we could. It was fun. It was lively. It was. I thought we were grappling with the real issues. And I was as sympathetic to the conservative press as I was to the liberals, because I felt they were both grappling with the issues in what was, in their way, an honest fashion.
Now, you say the conservative press. Was the conservative press entirely white, or was it mixed?
Well, there was the curious Turnhalla alliance that had their newspaper, or two or three. There were a lot of newspapers. And that alliance was a conservative white with a conservative black, as well as what were called bastards, or colored mixed race.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't that easy to say it was black and white. As I recall, the bastards were spread out all over the place, but there was a concentration of them south of Windhoek, just 30 miles or so, if I recall correctly. They were very conservative. A lot. Very conservative. They trusted the whites more than they trusted SWAPO. And it made the whole job of dealing with the press that much more interesting, because it wasn't purely a black-white issue.
Now, did you have to deal with the press in the initial period when SWAPO made the incursions into Namibia and the UNTAG had to agree to the non-cantonment of the South African troops? Did you have to handle that?
Well, I got my job as a result of that. The Tunisian guy arranged to show up on Marty Atassari's plane, mm-hmm. curiously enough. And there was an enormous amount of work with the press that had to be done for the day of Atassari's arrival. So I had done all of that. And of course, it was on the first day, I think, it was April 1st, that this crisis broke. And Marty sent Cedric up north to try to find out what was going on, because, typical of the UN, at the beginning of the mission, we had only a handful of our staff in place. We had no communications equipment. And if the South Africans said that SWAPO had crossed the border from Angola heavily armed, We had no independent way of verifying that. Cedric went north, and the Tunisian suddenly had a huge press corps because, wow, now you had blood and guts. They were pouring out of Europe, coming down, and there must have been 50, 60 journalists hammering this poor Tunisian with tough questions, whose answers were no comment or read the documents. He didn't have the touch. And so the journalist said to Cedric when he got back, fire your spokesman. They didn't fire him. He stayed on as director of information. But I was made the spokesman of the mission. And I myself went up to the border about the time that the whole thing had settled down and we had agreed on a plan to repatriate any SWAPO that were still in the country but in hiding because they didn't trust the South African military. And so we agreed to set up border checkpoints where these people could turn themselves in, be disarmed, and be escorted back across the border to Angola. And every place we had a little tent, and we had no flagpoles, so we would attach the UN flag to the tallest tree nearest our tent. The South Africans moved in right next door and set up a military encampment that would have been the pride of any modern army. Armored vehicles, jeeps, trucks, the whole business. And needless to say, very few SWAPO came to our little site with so many South Africans just next door. But there was a wounded guy, SWAPO guy, who came into our tent. And the South Africans wanted to interview him. The British fellow present was the military guy in charge was a British major, and Cedric was also there with me, as I recall. And the South African said, we want to interrogate the prisoner. And the major said, no way, he's our guy and you can't have access to him. So the South Africans raised their automatic weapons and pointed them at the major, and he still said, over my dead body. So they said, we'll be back in 1 hour, and if you don't turn him over, we'll take him. So they left. So the major got on the horn to Windhoek. The British had Motorolas in their jeeps, and they had a communications unit that could talk to those Motorolas. It was the only communications we had at the time. So they called the British base, which was 4 miles outside of Windhoek, saying, please get to the force commander or Atassari and ask them what we do. That jeep then called UN headquarters, UNTAG headquarters. It was dinner hour. Both the force commander and the special representative were having dinner somewhere in Windhoek. The jeep went from restaurant to restaurant. I mean, only 15 or 20 restaurants, but still there's enough that you couldn't get to all of them in an hour. And so Cedric took the decision and said to the major, tell him your force commander says to hold the line. So the major went back out and these guys came up with their weapons again and he drew a line in the dirt and he said, you cross that line and we'll shoot. And the South Africans backed off. But it's an illustration of how the lack of communications from the beginning of a mission, the lack of the infrastructure, if you get any unusual challenge to the mission, we had the challenge on day one, April 1st, you're at a loss to deal with it competently.
Eventually, though, you developed a good communication system, right?
Yeah, apparently we had satellite dishes placed on a ship to save the cost of air transport. So 3 months or 4 months into the mission, suddenly all this good, sophisticated stuff showed up. And then by 6 months, we were state-of-the-art. By that time, of course, all the hard work had been done.
Who handled, you mentioned the Tunisian became the director of information. The programs were all developed in Windhoek that went out across the, when you did have a communication, that went out throughout the country?
Well, the other thing about the information program was that Cedric insisted from the beginning that it was going to be essential to have an information budget, a substantial information budget. And this was a country that had a communications infrastructure. You had telephone lines that linked the whole country. You had television that reached areas around Windhoek, radio that reached everywhere. So Cedric said, we want TV programs, we want radio programs, and we want printed materials. But, of course, in the typical UN way, we had very few resources with which to do this. So the radio programs were produced by a support staff, a single support staff woman, Lena Yakamopoulou, who researched, wrote, and produced a 5-minute daily radio program that got aired in the early morning and then once or twice throughout the day. And she became, I think, the single best known person in UNTAG, because people showering in the morning would have the radio on, and Lena had a rather deep, sexy voice, and so the men, in any case, used to fantasize about this exotic foreign woman in their midst who was describing the work of UNTAG on a daily basis. That was the single most successful thing we did, I think, in the information area. The television was a French woman who had been hired from the outside. I don't think she was a regular UN staff member. And she hired a crew locally, and she tried to do a program every couple of weeks or something, a 15-minute program. It was on a regular basis, whatever it was, and that got a certain amount of attention. And then we borrowed the art director from the information department in New York over their objections. We practically had to get Atasari himself to commandeer her. And she went back and forth, but she would stay several weeks at a time. And she went down into Katatura, the black township, got to know the artists, the cultural life there, found a particularly gifted Namibian artist and asked him, he did lino cuts, asked him to do lino cuts of Namibian faces of all different groups and make a vote poster. And that single poster, I think, is everyone's image of UNTAG. It was the best known thing. But she also did brochures, and when it came time, the idea of a code of conduct kind of came out of the blue. Cedric and some others were talking, and I don't know who takes credit for having thought of it, but they said, we need to put that out, and that she designed it and then did it in languages and distributed it throughout the country. We're talking about contributions by, you know, single individuals that suddenly were free just to get a job done, who did it well and then saw the positive results of it. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why everyone who participated in the mission felt elated by the experience.
And these were all produced on the ground, not in New York and sent out.
Well, she shopped around. I mean, she found that sometimes getting certain parts of the job done in New York and then moving it somewhere else to be printed worked. She could get it printed in South Africa cheaper than she could get it printed in Namibia, and she did it that way. That was another thing she did when she scouted around. She checked the cost of doing business in her area, and she worked out the cheapest way to do it, which was, I think, a little different depending on the project.
Speaking of New York, how did you perceive the relationship between UNTE and New York, and in particular the so-called Namibia Task Force?
Oh, well, it was my first mission, so I was particularly susceptible to what I'm told is universal, not just in the UN, but in the military of governments around the world. When you're on the ground, on the front lines, you feel you have an intimate understanding of the situation, and the people sending you orders from headquarters just don't understand what we're dealing with. If you just stay off our backs and let us do the job, we'll get it done right. New York was facing a revolt by the African group, as I understand. And, of course, the Secretary General is responsible for maintaining relations with member states. We serve member states, and he had a revolt on his hands. And we, I don't think, gave that sufficient weight, at least not at my level. We didn't. I was one of those who felt that if New York just minded its own business, that it was doing things for political reasons. We don't do things for political reasons. We have a mandate here to carry out. We're trying to carry it out in a business-like way. We only have 1 year to do it. We want to get it done right and on time. And if New York would just stop playing politics and let us do our work, everything would be fine. So that was my view of them.
Well, this, the New York attitude, of course, did reflect the influence of the so-called frontline states in the 9/11 movement. And I was wondering, did you have press representatives there from the frontline states, and were they at all hostile in their, or more noticeably hostile in their questioning than others?
No, my sense was that those who reported regularly, or even who came in and stayed for a week or two, quickly saw what we were doing and were sympathetic to it. I don't recall getting headquarters-type questions. We all sensed that Mr. Atassari's standing among Africans had plummeted as a result of his decision to let the South Africans out of base. The South Africans double-crossed him by behaving like brutes and rampaging through the north, killing everything in sight. So they made the political cost to him of taking that decision as high as possible. And of course, among the South Africans, you know, we talked about the gentlemen from the foreign ministry, but there were the security services, the military. It wasn't clear that everyone in South Africa wanted to see this Namibia experiment succeed. And of course, one of our jobs was to phase out the South African military, contain them, and have them then pack up and go home. So that was the politically most uncertain time for us, because when the chief is wounded, which was the case with Atassari, we didn't know if we were going to pull out or not. We didn't know whether, after the events of the 1st of April, whether the mission would even be completed. So it was a gradual, steady climbing out of that hole that we had been thrown into in the 1st of April. Getting Laguela as the deputy, and then it turned out to be a good deputy, and then he and Atassari got along. And then he was gradually reaching out to these others. I will say that the frontline states and non-aligned movement all had offices or had representatives in Windhoek. Those people were more sympathetic to us than their bosses out of Namibia. And but at the same time, they were critical of us, and they had their instructions from headquarters. And it was most gratifying to us at the end of the process when they came up to us and said, you know, job well done, because they had been consistently critical of what we did. And there were times when we really felt that they wanted to fire us all, but I didn't sense it so much from the press.
That's interesting. Now, the political parties, particularly SWAPO and Sam Nujoma himself, what were their relations, or what was the relationship with UNTAG like? How was it carried out? Was it mostly in the field, or did Atassari meet with them on political questions?
I don't think they trusted us, because my impression, at least at the beginning, was that they felt that Namibia was theirs, that the UN was there to turn over the country to them. And we felt that for our credibility, we needed to carry out the mandate in an impartial manner. And we were dealing with the South Africans, I think, a lot more than we were dealing with SWAPO. And SWAPO for us was just one other political party. My impression was, though, that SWAPO did not make any serious political mistakes. And their organization was good, and they had an uphill battle, and also the South Africans had an idea of what percentage of the vote they were to get. And there was a time when I wasn't sure that this election was entirely free and fair. It seemed to me like people were trying to reach a certain outcome, a victory by SWAPO, but not an overwhelming victory. And of course, that's how it ended up. But once they won the election, they too turned to us with a lot of gratitude. But before then, there were times when they suspected we were colluding with the South Africans. And as I say, our relations were primarily with PNR and his people, the South Africans backing up those people, and then the contact, was it called the contact group?
Yes.
The contact group. Ahtisaari was always pushing buttons in that area, as we had to do after the 1st of April, because he called together the contact group, and from what they described, they met at a safari lodge somewhere. They cleared all the honeymooners out of a safari lodge for a weekend, and they had this meeting there, and I was not allowed in on it. But what people said was that, you know, the Russians, the Cubans, the Americans, the Angolans, they all said the same thing, that SWAPO had done something very stupid. And how do we get this peace process back on track? So I think that's where they came up with this idea of the border points where the remaining SWAPO could safely go back to Angola and so on. SWAPO was just a political party, and I think the real players were the South Africans, the Angolans, the Russians, the Americans.
Mm-hmm. Actually, that group was not, I thought you were talking about another group, the contact group. The contact group was the one of the Security Council, the Western countries that originally